I feel like I've been coyote-ish in being in mainstream medicine as critiquing it at the same time. And that's certainly had its drawbacks. And it's sometimes detrimental when your tail sticks behind your white coat. It's a dead giveaway. So I've certainly been foolish like Coyote in my efforts to change modern medicine. Largely, I think, didn't succeed. But it was a good try. And who knows what will change in the future. But it strikes me that there's parallel healthcare systems now.
We are witnessing so many remarkable miracles in this modern age of medical sciences. But what about a wisdom that is capable of containing this intellectual genius? Please join me as I engage in conversations with remarkable healers from different traditions, as we explore wisdom that can both inspire and inform our work as 21st century healers. So welcome. Please join us on the Healers Council. Well, welcome, everybody, to the Healers Council, where we are exploring a wisdom that can both inspire and inform our work as 21st century healers. I have to say that I just love doing this podcast because it gives me an excuse to have conversations with really wonderful people. And today's guest is one of those wonderful people whose work I have really admired for so many years. And as we were just talking, our paths have crossed but not quite intersected for many years now. And so it's just great to have our guest today, Lewis Mel Madrona, joining us on the Wisdom Search in Modern Healthcare. So I'm going to start by introduction to Lewis's CV. Interesting in our conversation today, the difference between our story and our CV, right? They're not necessarily the same thing. But anyway, so Lewis is a man of many aspects of FASM. He is trained in allopathic medicine. He trained at Stanford University School of Medicine. And he also has a PhD in clinical psychology, I think neuropsychology as well. He has completed his residency training in family medicine and psychiatry with added qualification in geriatrics. And he is also one of those rare people who is boarded in the American Board of Integrative Medicine. He has been a faculty on several medical schools and most recently as faculty associate professor of family medicine at the University of New England and in Maine. And he continues his work with Aboriginal communities to develop uniquely Aboriginal styles of healing and healthcare for use in those communities that he is currently serving. He's interested in the relation of healing through dialogue and community, and particularly as it pertains to this thing that we call psychosis in our culture. And he is the author of several really best-selling books, Coyote Medicine, Coyote Healing, and Coyote Wisdom, and his most recent book on the power of story and the promise of narrative psychiatry, and also one on remapping the mind, the neuroscience of self-transformation through story. It's so remarkable that things that Lewis has been talking about for decades now, the science is eventually catching up with him. His book is a wonderful review of how modern neuroscience is really actually confirming the wisdom that he has been giving voice to for so many years. Lewis currently works with the Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness Group, which serves the five tribes of Maine. And he also works part-time at Acadia Hospital and with the Family Medicine Residency Program in Maine. Now, if that was not enough, Lewis also serves on, I think he actually founded the Coyote Institute for Studies of Change and Transformation. And I'm actually going to just read the mission statement of that institute, and you'll be able to see a link to that on the show notes, coyote-institute.org. But I thought it was really worth reading the mission statement of the Coyote Institute because it's really inspiring. It states, the Coyote Institute provides workshops, seminars, trainings, and consultations related to indigenous knowledge and practices, as well as personal and planetary transformation. The mission of the Coyote Institute, which is a nonprofit, is to enrich contemporary medicine and psychology with the knowledge and wisdom of indigenous cultures. We aim towards two-eyed seeing, which I know, we're going to talk about, that celebrates indigenous knowledge and wisdom, both in a complementary fashion, but without diminishing either. So I'm not going to read the next part of this mission statement, because I like to start the conversation with this, the next line of the mission statement, and that is that the Coyote is our muse. And so at this point, I'm going to actually kind of open up this conversation with you, Lewis. The totem of the Coyote, why did you choose that name for the Institute? Your books are all about coyote medicine. I have to say, it's really interesting these days how coyotes are springing up everywhere. I have a particularly large male coyote who walks past my house every evening between 6 and 7 p.m. And will give us a glance and nonchalantly. So coyotes are really, I think, are making themselves known again. And so why coyotes? And what's the significance in that totem?
Once upon a time, a coyote referred to someone who was a blend of cultures and or came from two different ancestral streams. And so I was always drawn to coyote because of being a mix of European and North American ancestral streams. But it's lost that connotation largely, and I think that in some respects, because of its use for people who smuggle other people across the border, Arizona and New Mexico. But if one looks at coyote across North America, he's really funny. And I think coyote's first rule would be have fun. And his second rule would be help out if you can. And so I think coyote challenges us to change. So coyote is like the court jester. He or she stands at the margins of institutions and howls into the abyss and points out that the emperor is naked, which no one wants to hear. And so coyote is transformation through humor, cajoling, and sometimes and also coyotes are survivors. They're the fastest growing species in North America, and they've spread throughout North America. And part of that is because if a coyote mother is killed, another coyote will take over mothering the pups. And that's not true with wolves. It's not true with bears either. The bears have other things going. But so I think coyote is an interesting symbol for modern times. Critic of corporate medicine and neoliberal capitalism, and humorous at the same time, and a survivor. So that's why I like coyote.
Is the coyote your personal totem? Would that be an appropriate way of putting it, or just the metaphor appeals to you?
Sadly, it does. It wasn't what I started out to do. I really would have preferred a bear, a lion, an eagle, a cougar. Mm-hmm. But coyotes seem to show up wherever I go, which is interesting. I feel like I've been coyote-ish in being in mainstream medicine and critiquing it at the same time. And that certainly had its drawbacks. And it's sometimes detrimental when your tail sticks behind your white coat. It's a dead giveaway. So I've certainly been foolish like Coyote in my efforts to change modern medicine. Largely, I think, didn't succeed. But it was a good try. And who knows what will change in the future. But it strikes me that there's parallel healthcare systems now. There's corporate medicine. And really, poor can only afford corporate medicine. And then there's this healing stream that the poor can't afford. And often the middle class can't afford it either. But it's thriving in the margins, though it shows no signs of taking over the mainstream. But the fact that it's thriving in the margins, I think, is fabulous. And, of course, hard as colonizers tried, they couldn't stamp out indigenous healing. So there's still curanderos in Mexico and the Southwest. There's still indigenous healers scattered throughout reservations in North America and reserves, India, Africa. So people are still here. And how this will all unfold, I have no idea. But our commitment is to promote the idea that these indigenous ideas, some non-indigenous people that had these ideas also. These ideas of relational medicine instead of transactional medicine, of paying attention to all aspects of a person, emotions, thoughts, spirituality, physical body, community, that these things matter. And of course, it's all Engel, 1977, wrote a classic paper on the psychobiosocial model for psychiatry, which has largely been ignored. Now I would add the psychobiosocial spiritual model. But it was a brilliant paper that we all talked about with great gusto. And it's largely gone by the wayside, at least in the profession. I think social workers like Bronfenbrenner and some people like that have really run with this idea. But we, in medicine, we tend to ignore social workers. My apologies to social workers, especially since my wife is a social worker. But so it's, for me at least, it's a confusing scene these days, the world of medicine and healing, and where it's going to go, I don't know. I suspect it's future generations who will take it to where it needs to go. Hopefully, we've given them some inspiration and some ideas to run with, and we'll see what they do. Or maybe we won't see what they do.
Maybe going back to Coyotes again, living in the space between worlds, in a transition point where the way forward is not clear and even the outcome is not clear, but Coyotes don't seem to worry too much about that.
I think it's still a question whether humans will survive climate change. And it's a number of people have written about the need for indigenous wisdom to bring our awareness to climate change and the environment, that we can't just keep doing what we're doing because we're ignoring the interconnectedness of everything. And the more we try to control the world, the more it backfires and doesn't work. So somehow we have to learn how to live in harmony on the earth. And I think indigenous people have been doing that for thousands of years in their own particular climates. And the difference, I think, really is this sort of greed-oriented capitalism that puts the bulk of the wealth in the hands of the few and encourages competition. Is contrary to collaboration and cooperation. It's like bringing laws of acquisition, all for me and none for you. So indigenous ways of thinking represent an antidote to that, a way of redesigning, transforming our thinking to be more caring for each other, more altruistic, less driven by profit. And there's a scholar I read a PhD dissertation on, indigenous business ethics. And the idea was that in ethical business, everyone wins. No one loses. Everyone walks away from the transaction feeling good. And that would be a wonderful goal to which to aspire.
Boy, so many rich threads that we could pick up on there that I have put some pins in. So you very quickly have moved into this perspective of our work as healers being beyond simply the person that's in front of us in our office or wherever it might be, to our role in communities, our role in how do we support, balance the right relationship with communities. As we think about that, we think about our modern 21st century healer, how's your experience of community different when you're wearing your white coat as an allopath versus you are practicing the philosophy of being somebody coming from the Native American healing tradition? How are those different, those relationships, those communities?
In allopathic medicine, foster community. It's very much individually oriented. And it's transaction, relation, from the standpoint of the institution. Any doctor is as good as another doctor for seeing this particular patient right now. So the idea of continuity over time is contrary to management of resources and problems. And I think I don't want to say HIPAA isn't necessary because it is, but privacy constraints that we work under encourage us to isolate and to avoid building community. And also, if we think about community as caring for people, we're more about caring about people. And the kind of deep personal relationships that develop in indigenous healing contexts, for example, would be considered unprofessional in the allopathy. We're supposed to maintain professional distance. We're not supposed to be friendly with the patients. We're supposed to keep strong boundaries between us. And that gets challenged in small communities, of course, where everybody knows everybody's business. And we certainly see that in Maine. But the places where these ideas really spring from, and places like New York City and Chicago, where the doctor class could be completely separate from the patient class, with some exceptions. And the exceptions were the doctors for the rich. And I've met a couple. They're interesting characters. But this idea that we all go to the same grocery store and we all eat at the same restaurant and we all get our car fixed by the same guy, you know, which is Earl Main, is an impulse. It just wouldn't happen in New York City. So some of these ideas they're very urban ideas of distance and even the notion of professionalism. And obviously we all want to have ethics. We all want to be helpful. And from the framework of the person who's seeking help and not necessarily from our framework. But when you take it to the limits, it becomes cold and almost robotic. We don't get people's stories for sure. And I did a project with chronic pain patients where we had medical students get their life stories, and we had a program that transcribed the life stories, and we gave them to their doctors to read. And over the course of a year, the quality of the doctor-patient relationship significantly improved, and the levels of pain significantly dropped in the patients. And so there was something about knowing more about people's lives that made the doctor-patient relationship better for both parties and also reduced pain.
You raise a lot of important questions and points there. This idea of being a professional, right? Professing to a specific code of behavior, regulations, etc. I heard you say a couple of times in the past, one of the key ways you identify a healer is in your community of what you might call indigenous healers is that they never call themselves healers, and certainly not shamans. What I'm hearing you say is that within that philosophy, essentially what you're seeking in someone to help you with your suffering is more like a friend or a companion, or I like that word journeyman, right? Somebody that will show up and be present to your experience as another human being, not as an expert who immediately then codifies and reifies your experience individually or together, simply in terms of lab results or statistics. Would that ring true?
Yes. And it makes me think of a story I heard about a young man who became an apprentice to an indigenous healer. And one of the first things they did was to send him into people's hospital rooms. And they said, sit with them and be encouraged. And so that was the beginning of his training. And interestingly, they didn't tell him how to be encouraged. They just said, sit with this person and be encouraged. And maybe we all know how to be encouraged or how to be a good listener. My friend, he calls responsive listening. He wants to replace active listening with the term responsiveness. And I remember there was a French psychiatrist who said that the greatest gift you can give someone is to listen to them without judgment or interpretation. And that's what indigenous healers do. And I always know when I'm in their presence because this peaceful feeling comes upon me. And I know that I can say anything and be. And it's such a rare feeling in contemporary urban society.
So I've also heard you say that the role of the healer is to open up a space that is safe and will allow the healing to occur. I guess that's what we're talking about, right?
And there's a, I don't know what to call him, the people who we would call healers in Lakota country had a meeting to decide what to call themselves, and they couldn't agree. And they finally settled on fix-it people. And there's a fix-it person named Larry Swallow, Pine Ridge, told us that what our job is to provide a safe space for the medicine to exist. And it's really taking away from this sort of aggrandized notion of the healer that Western culture has promoted, the powerful healer, such as John or God, someone to whom thousands of people flock, and bringing it back to common people. That healers are more ordinary. It's the medicine.
So I wonder. So I wonder that term, fix it people, it would suggest that something was broken. And I wonder whether the deepest insight about healing is that nothing's ever broken, it's just out of balance. So that term, are you comfortable with that idea of being, we changed people from being MDs to BPs, fix it people? It would simply seem to, at one level, it seemed to were just entrench this idea that doctors fix things because they're broken with their technology.
They were being healers.
I'm interested in how that fix it relates to that Native American perspective of healing.
Yeah, they were being humorous. And in reality. They didn't know what to call themselves. And furthermore, they wondered, why did they have to call themselves?
So there's the coyote.
From their point of view, why should they call themselves some?
Right. I'm just noticing that you're frozen, so I can always edit this out of the conversation. I think I can't hear you, so I don't know if you're speaking.
Can you hear me now?
It's still recording. Now I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, I don't feel frozen, though it's cold in this. But in the community, they wouldn't be called healers. They might be called elders, but it would be more the case that if you had a knee problem, someone might say, if I had that problem, I would go see Joe down the road, peace. Or someone might say, I'm worrying too much. And they might say, if I was worrying too much, I might go see Fred over there on the other side of the hill. So the need for labels begins with professionalization and advertising. And so if I'm not a professional and I'm not advertising, then why do I need a label? That would be the point of view that I saw at least. And I think it's complicated because once upon a time before communal societies, people took care of each other. But now under capitalism, everyone needs to make money or to receive money who makes it. But we all need to receive money in order to survive. So that brings up the need for trade guilds, professionalization, monetization. And sometimes that's the enemy of healing. One of the suggestions that we often make to people is to get together everyone they know who wants to be healed or to be healing and meet on a regular basis. No one pays anything. No one makes anything. But people come together to be healed for each other. Sort of like people come together to play board games. People come together for all kinds of purposes. But why not for healing? Because it's difficult when you always have to pay for healing. It rations it, restricts it. Which is not to say that I don't charge, because I do, because I have to. But I understand that it's not necessarily the best system. And of course, we never charge for ceremony, but it's confused to be the this 2IC is tricky business because the mainstream has more power than the other ways of speaking. And so we always have to dance around it, or at least acknowledge it in some way.
So I think what I hear you saying is that within this tradition, whilst technique's important, I mean, there might be, I believe, for example, the osteopathic tradition came out of Native American body work. I think I'm correct in that, that what's more important than the techniques or the skills is who you are as a human being is what's most important to the work of healing, and that nobody has a monopoly on that. And just about anybody in the community, particularly in community, can offer that work as a healer. Is that correct or no?
Yes. That one of the activities that we like to do is we call it healing camp, or it's like a healing hackathon. And we bring people together for a block of time in a retreat-like space, like the Nest in Woodstock, which you visit. And people discover what they have to offer. And people receive some of what they need. And what brought that up was one of the most healing bodywork sessions I ever had occurred during a healing camp in outside of Melbourne, Australia, that we did. And after the session, I asked the guy, I said, where did you learn to work like that with your hands? And he said, oh, I never did this before. I'm an accountant. So go figure.
He was a bean counter. Obviously, had very dexterous fingers, perhaps.
Right.
But, yeah. So this kind of brings me to a kind of a something that I know is central to the Healers Council, which is what we're really talking about here is in the Shantideva's vow, the Bodhisattva, way of the Bodhisattva, he says, may I be both the medicine and the doctor. So this idea of our own personal spiritual development in becoming a healer, perhaps that accountant, who knows, perhaps he was doing a lot of personal development when he, you know, outside being an accountant. But in this regard, you've had this incredible experience of walking these parallel roads in becoming, quote unquote, a healer in these two traditions, allopathy and your Native American tradition. And I was really intrigued to listen to you talk about your teachers on that journey outside allopathy. And I have some of their names. The ones that stood out for me were Grandfather Roberts, Marilyn Youngbird. Perhaps could you talk a little bit about the student-teacher relationship that you have experienced in that world as opposed to what it was like living in Western medical school, having a tutelage? What did you have healers and did you have teachers as you saw them in Stanford? Or anyway, so just difference between the two, but particularly to some of your experiences working with your teachers in that Native American tradition.
Mostly in that tradition, one hangs out and tries to be helpful. And I assisted Marilyn for some years with ceremony. And sometimes you don't even know when a teaching occurs until afterwards. Oh, I just got a teaching. And I went looking for one of my possible fathers in South Dakota, who was reported to be Lakota. I never found him, but I found Sonny Richards, with whom I spent many years. And really, it's just being in the moment while they do what they do, being present with them. And Sonny introduced me to Sundance, and that's been an ongoing part of my life. And so it's not like Stanford, where we took, we had textbooks and exams. It's more, you're like a junior carpenter. You're just helping out with whatever they're up to and learning as you go. And that's been with all of the really wonderful elders that I've had the opportunity to spend time with. That it was just showing up and being helpful.
When I hear you talk about what I see as a sense, a great deal of devotion that you have towards him, would that be a correct statement?
That would be true. And that would be true from most of the teachers, most of the elders whom I've had the privilege of spending time.
Yeah, as I spend time with Tibetan Buddhist teachers, that sense of deep devotion and gratitude for what they have actually gained from that relationship with their teacher. It's unfortunately, I think we would use different adjectives to describe our experience with our teachers in allopathic school. I don't think devotion and gratitude, maybe some gratitude. Yeah, I have gratitude for some of the brilliance, of the scientific brilliance that they have imparted. And yes, I have to say that my true teachers, if I think about my own journey, are those ones that I do have some gratitude. I have great gratitude and devotion to, although it's not as clear near to the surface, perhaps, as what you've described. So this journey to becoming a healer in that tradition involves a personal transformation beyond simply the acquisition of facts.
It changes one. Yes, it is transformative. One grows and changes. I think grows into more compassion, more kindness, more altruism. Develops these qualities, which one doesn't have to develop in contemporary medicine. Should we take a break and finish on another sitting?
Sure, if that's what you want to do. Maybe we can wrap up this little section so it has some sense of completeness.
Sure.
Maybe I just make a statement just to summarize what you just said. And then I was thinking that, of course, we haven't even got to that story and relationship. Yeah. So maybe that could be really the focus. I can give a teaser about the next session. We're really going to start moving into the value, the power of stories.
Let me get my appointment book.
Right.
And I'll be right back.
Okay.
And then we can wrap up.
Okay. So I am just talking here to fill in the space, which is going to be edited out once we finish the section. And I'm just putting a pin in the section, and we're pretty much 45 minutes in session one, and we're going to meet again for session two. And session two is really going to be focusing on the power of story. And that's going to be a nice lead-in. I think we've covered a lot of good stuff today. Cover a lot of really meaningful information. And I think the conversation we're going to have on story is going to be, I think, be a nice bookend to the conversation that we're having now. So I'm just talking away. I'm not really covering anything in particular. Okay, so Eric Lewis is back. I'm just talking to hold the space here. Okay, so great. So that's what we can do, Lewis, is I will just round off this part one with a comment. And if you have any statement following that, and then we can turn off the record button and we can schedule the next one. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good.
Great. Well, we've just covered so much. I think the fundamentally most important aspect of this work and the wisdom of healing is around who we are and what it is that we bring into that relationship with somebody who is also suffering is really central. And I just love, Lewis, I think we could talk for a long time about your experience with your teachers and the personal transformation. But I think you captured it so beautifully when you said what you experienced most of all was an increased experience of compassion and loving kindness as being central to your work as a healer. That was much more important than perhaps the skill sets that you learn from textbooks. And of course, that brings me back to a quotation, which I'm going to paraphrase, to say the least, from Sun Tse Miao in the Yellow Emperor's textbook, when he says, when the knowledge of healing moved from the lineage into textbooks, it became far inferior. And I think that kind of captures what I think you're describing. Is there anything that you want to add to that before I make a final comment to wrap up today's conversation?
I think we as a society, we as a profession, we need to come together and ask ourselves, how can we bring more compassion into healthcare? How can we bring more kindness and love into healthcare? And I suspect the accountants have to be part of the conversation. And it just needs, we need to do this because medicine has become less personal, more robotic, I think less healing in the years that I've been practicing. And we forget that sometimes illnesses just go away without our doing anything. Or maybe what was done was part of the great mystery. And we become so fixated on doing that we lose track of being with each other. And I'd like to see us change that.
So that's where we are, right? In our evolutionary impulse. As a species, perhaps the most meaningful healing we can bring is to my own tradition. We talk about outer, inner, and secret teachings. I think we've based on capitalism and accountants, but actually, but that story that you shared about the most powerful healing session was actually with an accountant when he did his body work with you. And really what you were able to bring forth, he was able to bring forth was that inner capacity to be compassionate and be kind in some way that engage with your own energetic system. And so maybe that's the most important work to be done in healing. And I have sadness and frustration that perhaps the most important work we as allopaths should be doing today is actually begin to mobilize around this vision of compassion and loving kindness. If 2 million physicians in the United States, for example, were to rally around the importance and the centrality of compassion and loving kindness, the world would change. And so this is not as a revolution, but as a velvet evolution towards some better way of being in relationship with each other as a community. But what we can do, I heard you made reference to a Thomas Merton quote, and I'm trying so hard to remember it. Do you remember what that quote was about this?
Yeah, Merton said,
make that quote a while ago, but something, do you remember that?
Yes. He said, always do the right thing, even if you're sure that it's not going to.
There you go. So what we can do is take the next right step organized around compassion and loving kindness. I just really so appreciate you joining us. I know this has been, I think we've created a space in our conversation today where we have been able to explore ways of being that aren't fully accessible to us in our modern world, particularly our healthcare system. And I'm really delighted that we're going to meet again. So I just wanted people to know we're going to get together again for another session with Lewis Malmedrana. And I think we're going to really dive into what you might call his specialty, right? Which is storytelling, narrative healing. He's written about this. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. I know we're going to go in all kinds of different directions, even delving deep into neuroscience and the default mode network. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I hope that the stories, I hope you'll join us for that next part of our conversation with Lewis. And thank you so much for joining me, Lewis, and joining our community. And I look forward to the next time we can create space together.
Thank you. Me too.
Thanks. You take care. Bye-bye.